growing up in the Pine Grove community, I now realize much later as an older adult that we were environmentalists long before the word became popular. We rotated our crops, and even when we cut wood, mostly to heat our homes, because most of us had wood stoves, we only cut enough wood to last us through the winter. Those farmers and residents who did cut wood out of the wooded areas on their property cut those trees down to make room and to make light for the other trees to grow. So it was like a thinning out process that they used.
I'm Naya Bates, a graduate student in the History Department at Princeton University, and this podcast is about the intersections of historic preservation, environmental racism, and environmental justice, as experienced by one community in Virginia's South Central Piedmont. Cumberland County, Virginia is deeply rural. Where I'm from, we would call it the boonies or the sticks. The total population of the county is under 10,000 residents. In fact, the average commute to work for the people who venture to live there is approximately 40 minutes. For city dwellers who are used to sitting in traffic, this probably seems low. But in reality, it means driving 30 or 40 miles in any direction. The community of Pine Grove, located in the northeast section of Cumberland County, is roughly 1 hour southeast of Charlottesville and 1 hour southwest of Virginia's capital city of Richmond. Even the closest grocery stores are a 30-minute drive for folks living in Pine Grove.
I am Sonia Branch Wilson. Let me say that when I was younger, I hated to go to Cumberland, okay? Oh, we're gonna go to Cumberland, you know, said my grandparents or my parents, or we're gonna ride down the Cumberland. Great. The only time of the year that I was excited about going to Cumberland was Labor Day weekend when we used to have our annual family reunion, because it was seeing all of our cousins, you know, young and old, my age, and, you know, the elders, and we would play, you know, we would get on that rusty swing that had probably been there a thousand years, but we were on it. Then we would smell the food and we would see, you know, wait to see which cars were going to come up the gravel. You could hear them before they would come, and we would look and see what color car it was, because depending upon whose car it was, you know, either you had the potato salad or desserts or, you know, something yummy coming.
Mrs. Muriel Miller Branch and her family have lived in Cumberland County for many generations. She reverse migrated to Cumberland from Montclair, New Jersey, where her father took ownership of his uncle's 40-acre farm when she was just 3 years old. Mrs. Branch's great uncle, Warner Mayo, built their farmhouse in the Cartersville area of Cumberland in the 1880s. She says she grew up surrounded by family and a close-knit community. Like many counties in the eastern half of Virginia, in the Piedmont and Tidewater regions, Cumberland County built its wealth on the backs of enslaved people. The Mayo, Miller, Dungy, and Agee families in Pine Grove are descendants of those enslaved laborers and retain deep ties to the land that their ancestors cultivated. In 1860, there were twice as many enslaved Afro-Virginians living in Cumberland as free whites. They made up 67% of the total population, which placed Cumberland in the top three slaveholding counties by total percentage of the population. There was also a very small population of free black residents who primarily worked as laborers on farms and mills, at industrial sites, or as boatmen. In Cumberland, tobacco was king, specifically the brightleaf variety that was first identified in Caswell County, North Carolina, in the late 1830s. They liked this variety because it could be grown in poor soil, which was common because other darker-leafed varieties had drained the soil in Cumberland of its nutrients and productivity. Poor roads and unimproved waterways made access to the deeply rural countryside treacherous and limited other industries and crops from being profitable in the county. This exacerbated class divisions by creating a wealthy class of planters and plantation owners, an underclass of overseers and other poor whites, and a black population, free and enslaved, that was consistently exploited. These conditions did not change with the arrival of legal freedom at the conclusion of the Civil War. The Agees, Mayos, Millers, Dungies, and at least 16 other black families in the Pine Grove and Cartersville area of Cumberland County were employed doing similar work as they had done under the harsh regime of slavery. Many worked on their own farms, and those who did not worked as farm laborers for other landowners. Everyone in the community was deeply committed to making sure that their families had access to education. Between 1865 and 1910, black residents in Cumberland constructed one-room schools for educating people, young and old. By 1910, they opened a high school in Cartersville named Hamilton High School. Hamilton was part of a larger turn in Virginia toward Booker T. Washington's model of industrial education for African Americans all across the United States South, which included normal education to prepare women to become teachers. With $50 in support from the Julius Rosenwald Foundation, designs created by Robert Robinson Taylor, a black architect from Tuskegee Normal and Industrial Institute, $500 raised by black residents, and $1,000 from the county school division, men from the Pine Grove community constructed and opened the Pine Grove Elementary School in 1917. From 1917 until 1954, Pine Grove Elementary served to educate students from pre-kindergarten all the way through seventh grade.
My dad was 3 years old when Pine Grove School was built. So it was there. And actually he attended until fifth grade, I think. And that's when he had to drop out.
Starting at the age of five, Mrs. Branch also attended Pine Grove Elementary in the last few years before the school was closed as a result of school desegregation in Virginia. Unlike the neighboring county of Prince Edward, Cumberland County did not close schools to avoid integration. In fact, they broke away from Prince Edward's policy of massive resistance by creating an independent school district, which has resulted in the sites in Cumberland being added to the Civil Rights in Virginia Education Heritage Trail. Mrs. Branch has vivid memories of her time at Pine Grove, including the special privilege of attending school early, before the age most students were allowed to attend.
We walked 3.5 miles to Pine Grove School. Now, that was a ritual, both going to school and walking from school. There were these rituals. And one was because we lived further away than any of our cousins that we picked up along the way. We would stop at each lane because we had these long lanes. Everybody lived back off these dirt roads. And we would stop at each of the lanes. And when we get close, we had a little call and response that we would do. And we'd say, hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo, hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo. And if they were on their way, they say, woohoo! And we did that at every lane so that they would know that, you know, we were getting close and we were, you know, would be moving on. So we'd wait for a little while and then we go to the next lane and we do the same thing. It didn't look like 3.5 miles because we kept gathering our family and our friends as we walked along the way and kicking rocks and, you know, with sticks and chasing each other and playing tag. And it's a wonder we even made it to school. So by the time we got to school, you know, Mrs. Gillum was standing at the door with the little bell. If ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling, and if you weren't there, you had better move and move really, really quickly, because she did not ring that bell but once.
And after you got there, what was your school day like?
School day consisted of a lot of listening. I remember a lot of listening because you have to understand that there were 7 grade levels. And the only way you knew what grade you were in was the row of seats that you sat on. And so Mrs. Gillum would start with the younger children and then move back. So while we were doing our work, that she would move from row to row to row. Well, little Miss Muffet, me, would hurry up and get my work done. And I would be listening to what was going on behind me with the older children. So I think there was a lot of incidental or vicarious learning, but it was a buzz. You know, there was always paper shuffling, and I can remember the pencil, the sound of the pencils on the paper. But the real thing that I remember was that chalk, the sound of the chalk on the black, we didn't have chalkboard. They were called blackboards. And then you had the fire in the winter, the crackling of the wood and the sparks coming out of the stove. Every month or so, the men would get together and put some kind of oil on the wood, on the floors, sweep them really good, scrub them, and then they put this oil, and boy, you had to tip around pretty. You really had to tip around for a few days until that oil, you know, soaked into the wood. But basically, our books were hand-me-downs from the white schools. They were ragged and tattered, and we would, Ms. Gillum taught us how to make book covers out of paper bags. And that's how we design our own covers for the books and, you know, make them as pretty as we could. But she didn't seem to rely totally on the books. Some days she would fill that blackboard with things that were not in the book, that she remembered or that she thought we needed to know. So everything that we learned didn't come from those tattered books. And oftentimes there were pages missing. So she had to kind of adapt the lessons for that. On Fridays, that was a really special day because that's how I started school. She would allow me, not a lot of five-year-olds, because you couldn't go to school until you were six in Cumberland. And she allowed me to come with my brother and sister and on Fridays. And then later on Fridays, that was our spelling bee, where you'd line up in front of everybody and she would call off these words and you would spell them until you were eliminated. So that was a big deal because, you know, sometimes she would do it by grade level. And if you competed with some of the older people, you were a hot shot.
A few weeks ago, I had an opportunity to visit with Mrs. Branch at Pine Grove with a historic preservation planning class from the University of Virginia, taught by longtime historic preservationist and planner Genevieve Keller. On our tour, we were harassed by a white man who moved into the area just 5 years ago. He demanded to know what we were doing, and when Mrs. Branch pushed him on why he was bothering us, very clearly a group of students with backpacks and notepads, he suggested that, quote, the community has recently had trouble with, quote, prowlers. Right. Us. Prowlers. After the disruption, Mrs. Branch reflected on when the social and racial demographics began to change in her community.
That started in the 50s as families had to seek employment elsewhere. The schools, once they graduated from the normal school or the training school, Cumberland County Training School, there was nothing to do but farm. By this time, farming was just not sustainable because the white farmers had the acreage for the most part. And the one cash crop that we had, most Black farmers had, was tobacco. Cumberland County found a way to cut the allotments of the Black farmers while increasing the allotments of the few white farmers that were even in the community. So educational opportunities, economic opportunities were the two things that caused the outward migration of Blacks from my community. Then what happened was, as my age group began to migrate out of the community, the property started changing hands. And then Continental Canning Company came in and they an opportunity to take advantage of the economic downturn, the economic stress on Black farmers. And they started buying up land everywhere. And so that's how some of that land that we used to own was subdivided and, you know, just they don't live anywhere near the community, but they had deep pockets. And if you're poor and someone offers you $1,000 an acre or $500 an acre or $250 an acre back in that day. You took it. That was a lot. That was more money than you had ever known.
Since 2018, Black and white residents living in the Pine Grove neighborhood have been battling the construction of a mega landfill by a New York-based company called Green Ridge Recycling and Disposal. The company received plan and permit approvals from the Cumberland County Board of Supervisors, who supported the project because it would bring jobs and tax revenue to the area. Mrs. Branch and other residents have mounted a fierce opposition to the project on the basis that the proposed landfill will disturb graves of her family's enslaved ancestors, reroute historic roads, and cut off access to the Pine Grove community to accommodate new traffic from dump trucks, and contaminate groundwater, among other things. If the plan goes through, the Pine Grove School that anchors the cultural landscape of the Black community will be surrounded on three sides by a mega landfill that will accept between 3,500 and 5,000 tons of waste per day. According to Green Ridge, the waste would come from places within a 500-mile aerial radius, excluding New York and New Jersey. So what's within a 500-mile aerial radius from Cumberland, you ask? 20 other states, from as far south as Georgia, as far north as parts of Vermont, almost all of the eastern seaboard, and Michigan, Indiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, and even a sliver of Alabama. Toronto, Canada, is within the 500-mile radius of Cumberland County, too. And here's the kicker. The dump will only provide around 30 jobs. In a county where nearly 20% of residents are living in poverty and the median income hovers just above $46,000 annually, is this really good investment? Is this the kind of development that will truly support people living in Cumberland? For Sonia Branch Wilson, these developments are devastating.
It infuriates me because when I see my great uncle standing in his tobacco fields, or if I see my grandfather building and I see the homes, this was their community. And also to see the headstones that my grandfather made out of, I think it was limestone, and his etching, his handwriting, you know, in those headstones for a company who has no connection to the community, no connection to the land, is willing to come and disrupt that rest and could care less about the ancestral souls who are there, their burial grounds. It is really, it's more than disheartening. It just makes me really angry. Like, how dare you? You know, how dare you? Who are you to do something like this? To try to bully a community.
Green Ridge Recycling and Disposal offered Mrs. Branch and the AMMD Pine Grove Project Group, who now owns the school property, $100,000 to stop their protest. In an op-ed for the Farmville Herald newspaper, Mrs. Branch wrote, quote, "We make no apology for not accepting the $100,000, as we are smart enough to know that those few dollars would be hush money, a way of silencing us. We make no apology for raising the alarm about the adverse environmental and health impacts a landfill in our midst would have on lifelong residents of the community. We make no apology for questioning the so-called buffer for a 692-feet-high landfill or the smell and dust the landfill and traffic would cause. We make no apology for not wanting to disturb the 22 formerly enslaved souls buried behind Pine Grove School or further decimate their memory by having garbage piled on them. We make no apology for advocating for what is right and just and for calling attention to America's long history of environmental racism in communities of color who have no high-paid lobbyists to speak for us. I spoke with historic preservationist and urban planner Genevieve Keller about her pro bono work to help Mrs. Branch and the Pine Grove community. We started our conversation by talking about the intersections of historic preservation and environmental racism and environmental justice.
I'm Genevieve Keller. I usually describe myself as an architectural historian, preservation planner. I'm a founding principal of a small preservation and landscape architecture firm in Charlottesville, Virginia, Atlantic Community Associates. And for the last 5 or 6 years, I've been adjunct faculty in historic preservation at the University of Virginia. And because we were starting our practice in 1975, we were very close to the environmental movement of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and to all of the environmental acts that came about through the Johnson and Nixon administrations. You know, so I always say that the Historic Preservation Act of 1966 was at the vanguard of those environmental acts, maybe being the most conservative of them, but there was a federal mandate to review and protect historic resources before clean air and clean water. Our profession, historic preservation, was actually born in issues of racial and environmental injustice in a kind of overzealous overpatriotism that glorified whiteness and masculinity and elitism. And it intentionally obscured and suppressed the contributions of people who were not white and male and elite. Even the way we name properties, you know, even the homes of the elite, it may have come to a man through his wife's dower or through his mother's inheritance, but it's still going to have his name. You know, so at the very essence of the survey process, it's male and it's white. And so the first people who were surveying Virginia were male and were white. And I think that just, you know, trickled down and it came out of our museum heritage, you know, and then you overlay NEPA and the Historic Preservation Act on that. But people weren't looking for slave dwellings and smokehouses and joineries and all of those other things. And in fact, they saw them as ugly and they removed them from the landscape. And in doing so, they suppressed that. And there were intentional places as well where people were concerned about the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, of the riots. Places in the Shenandoah Valley felt they were very close to Washington, DC. And that if they still had records that proved that they had enslaved people on their farms, they would deliberately destroy those.
Right, there's something different about being the birthplace of America and dealing with these issues.
Right. I mean, we came in and displaced killed the indigenous people. And within, you know, less than a decade, really, then we started a race-based enslavement process. And then we were a major battleground of the Civil War. And now we have more Confederate monuments than any other place in the United States. And we had massive resistance and a very vigorous Jim Crow and genetics, and we influenced Germany. You know, we are the place. I was saying to someone yesterday, really the whole of the Commonwealth of Virginia should be a site of conscience, you know, because we are so culpable in so many ways. We're so rich in other ways. I don't want to damn all of it because I think there's some good that comes out of the preservation movement, but I think we can use preservation to look more deeply in that history and take responsibility for what we did and take responsibility for how we're going to repair it.
So, where do we go from here? Over the past few years, Virginia has seen a number of reactionary preservation projects brought forward by communities of color fighting major development and infrastructure projects, not to prevent productive development, but rather to protect the desecration of sacred grounds and irreplaceable history. In Buckingham County, the Black community in Union Hill successfully fought against a proposed Dominion Virginia Power compressor station on the basis that it would disproportionately negatively impact their community. In the process, they created Virginia's first Freedmen's Historic District, the only rural historic district in the state focused solely on Black historic resources. At Rossawek, the Monacan Indian Nation, a federally recognized sovereign tribe, is embroiled in a tense battle to prevent the James River Water Authority from building a pump station and pipeline that would disturb over 20 ancestral burial sites. Rossawek has been their capital for over 5,000 years and 200 generations. In Charles City County, residents are in a similar situation as the community in Pine Grove, facing the construction of another mega landfill. And in Richmond, descendants of enslaved and free Black Richmond residents created a historic district as part of their battle to save the Shaco Hill African Burial Ground from being further desecrated by the construction of a high-speed rail connecting D.C. to Richmond, Virginia. In the United States, less than 2% of historic sites on the National Register of Historic Places are associated with African American history. While structural inequities with the process remain a primary source of this imbalance, for example, criteria that is hyper-focused on the built landscape at the expense of cultural landscapes, oral history, and intangible heritage, centuries of dispossession and displacement have left us with communities and histories that are difficult to identify and locate through traditional data sources like the census and windshield surveys. Practitioners have ignored and overlooked places of significance to communities of color. New property owners have torn down or otherwise destroyed buildings and landscapes that weren't pretty, despite knowledge of their historical significance, like the Underground Railroad site that was recently torn down in Petersburg, Virginia, for example. Urban renewal and other forced erasures for the sake of development have made those landscapes difficult to identify, even on maps. Jeannie Keller, Andrea Roberts, Lakshmi Ford, and others working in this space have testified to the tremendous power of local knowledge as one strategy for locating and preserving communities that exist at the margins or have not yet been mapped.
Local knowledge of environments is an essential part of environmental justice. It is something that hasn't been built into most preservation projects in an integral way, beyond using the traditional and often white and well-off owners of historic legacies. And it often requires public comment for environmental reviews and historic designations. But the sad thing about public comment is that it does not necessarily inform the process, nor need to be heeded, and it usually comes at the end of a project rather than at the beginning. It's just a mandated part of a process. And in many instances, communities of color may be outnumbered and outfunded, and their voices may not be heard. I certainly know that in my own work, I've made mistakes, especially when local knowledge was not funded and built into the process. Students in my preservation planning class at UVA are learning more and more from local leader, the Reverend Muriel Branch, about burial traditions, historic pathways, and lack of internal boundaries in her beloved Pine Grove community. And as you well remember, you and I first met because your African American descendant community had not been included as informants, decision makers, and supporters of the Southwest Mountains Rural Historic District, while the descendants of plantation-owning enslavers played a major role in developing and informing that project. So I think we've come to a point where many of us are realizing that environmental justice demands that we do better and that we value local knowledge so that we can repair past damage and that we can repair the narrative and repair the designations to ensure protections that are equitable and inclusive.
in the future.
Members of the Pine Grove community also share similar ideas about local memory and local knowledge. However, they also frame the challenge around shifting ideas about cultivating the next generation, focusing on the good types of development and educating the public on the history. Mrs. Branch, her cousin Dorothy Rice, and daughter Sonia Branch Wilson are building a coalition in this fight.
I think the Pine Grove Project is an opportunity to share with the immediate community, because I'm not so sure the people that are there really are that invested in this legacy. They've probably taken it for granted, like so many people do when you have something, and it's only when you're on the verge of losing it do you want to try to save it.
And agriculture is so different now. So I think maybe we need to look at agriculture differently. You know, you've got the hydroponics, you've got the all kinds of agricultural type industries that are popping up. So I think it's incumbent upon us as an organization to, as I wrote in that op-ed, that we need to show people what we're for and come up with some plans that we can offer. If we can get a park, a nice park at Pine Grove, and get the school restored, that will be a green space for people to be able to claim, to come and use and claim and gather. All of those things that rebuild community. Tourism, we could get Cumberland, we could get the cemeteries, the schools in that area, even into Buckingham, as a part of a historic tour, bringing tourism into the community, somehow linking that huge green space called Bear Creek Lake to these rural sites as a part of, you know, the recreational industry. There's so many things that we can do to attract younger people. We need to get together with the school system and help them envision what could be and prepare their young people for what could be. There's too much apathy and complacency because of poverty. The people feel defeated.
I think my mother said something very powerful, and you witnessed it on Friday, and I've stated it several times. And I don't want to refer to them as this, but it's kind of, I really don't know another word to say that would describe them outside of newcomers. They're new to the community. They do not know the history of the community. They haven't cared to know the history of the community. They just see it as a quiet, quaint place where the neighboring community, Powhatan, has developed so much. You know, you would ride and you would go up Route 60 and keep going. And at one point it was like civilization cut off, okay? Because it was just trees and a house here and there. But Powhatan has really blossomed now. There's still no supermarket there. they're still, you know, they're just, you have the gas station that sells good food, by the way. They have great food at the Stop and Go. You have the Dollar General.
No medical facilities,
right. You have a library, a post office. I'm trying to think. I'm going up Route 60 and you hear my pauses because I'm thinking, you know, as we're traveling up and down 60, what's there? But there's nothing there. One of my cousins, she calls it Mayberry. It's still Mayberry, you know. So what's going to happen is that cycle from my mother's generation is going to continue where the opportunities are not there for the children to stay. What are the 2021 graduates going to do? Why would they stay in Cumberland? So that means there's more Black land that, you know, if you have elders in the family, that land would be passed down. Now these children in 2021, they're going to thrive, you know, speaking it into an existence for them. And then why are they going to come back? Unless they have that history connection tied in and linked.
That was a Black community. The ratio was like 60 to 10 within a 6-7 mile radius. We created, built, sustained that community until about the 60s, mid 60s at that. And that's when the mass exodus of Black kids, young Black people went out of that area. We are the placemakers.
Although the Black residents in Pine Grove stand to lose the most from the construction of the Green Ridge Recycling and Disposal mega landfill, environmental racism and inequality hurt everyone in Cumberland. The county's leaders have prioritized corporate gains and tax revenue over the welfare of their own residents. That's a self-devouring type of growth that doesn't make possible a future where Cumberland County's residents can escape poverty, stay on the land, and build strong connections with the people around them. The 30 or so jobs created by allowing the landfill are only guaranteed for the life of the landfill, which is estimated at around 30 to 35 years. And then what? The damage to the waterways and the rerouting of historic roads and pathways and the desecration of the burial grounds of enslaved people will already be done. The county will be left with 1,200 acres of unproductive land, potential park space for people who will have already moved away to find better opportunities elsewhere. Cumberland leadership could choose instead to invest in the types of future-oriented development that are informed by how Pine Grove's residents lived in the past, in sync with the land and in community with each other. That's all the time I have for this episode. I would like to thank Mrs. Muriel Miller Branch, Mrs. Dorothy Rice, my sister, Sonia Branch Wilson, and Genevieve Keller for participating in this podcast. Thanks for listening.